Picture yourself at 49, collapsing on the floor in convulsions while your daughter watches in horror. You're a Hollywood icon. Your face has graced magazine covers worldwide, and you've earned millions. Yet in this moment, you can't even control your own body. This is where Demi Moore found herself in 2012, after inhaling nitrous oxide and synthetic marijuana at a party in her own home. Her daughters had stopped speaking to her. Her marriage was over. Her health was failing. And finally, after decades of running, she had nowhere left to hide. What makes Moore's story so compelling isn't the glamour or the famous relationships. It's the raw honesty about what happens when you spend your entire life trying to be enough for everyone except yourself. Her memoir reveals a truth many of us recognize. Sometimes the most successful-looking people are fighting the hardest battles with themselves. The woman who became the highest-paid actress in Hollywood, who appeared on that iconic Vanity Fair cover pregnant and radiant, who seemed to have it all, was actually a child who never stopped searching for the love she didn't receive at home. Growing up in Roswell, New Mexico, Moore learned early that love required constant scrambling. Her father, Danny, left her mother, Ginny, a single dollar each morning, enough for one giant Pepsi. They moved constantly, following Danny's affairs and gambling debts, switching schools at least twice yearly. Young Demi became a detective in each new environment, quickly assessing power dynamics and figuring out how to fit in. At 11, she woke to find her mother attempting suicide. Using her small fingers, she dug pills from her mother's mouth while her father screamed directions. Childhood ended that night. Then came another revelation. Danny wasn't her biological father. The ultimate betrayal came at 15, when a middle-aged man named Val raped her after gaining access to their home, apparently with her mother's complicity. He whispered afterward, "How does it feel to be whored by your mother for $500? For years, she didn't recognize this as rape, instead blaming herself. This devastating experience established a pattern that would define her relationships for decades. Love and exploitation intertwined, trust and betrayal inseparable. At 16, Moore escaped to live with Tom Dunston, a 28-year-old musician. Her mother secured her a receptionist job at 20th Century Fox, bringing brief stability: school, work, acting classes, routine. But her parents reported her as a runaway, shattering that fragile normalcy. She left Tom for Freddie Moore, a charismatic 29-year-old married musician, and began modeling, an industry that reinforced the toxic idea that her value existed solely in her appearance. When her father died by suicide at 36, Freddie offered no comfort, coldly saying there was no point in crying. 2 months later, she married him anyway, though she'd cheated the night before. She couldn't face the truth. She was marrying to avoid grieving. As her family disintegrated, her career exploded. General Hospital, then Blame It on Rio. Success brought cocaine dependency and reckless behavior. Her breakthrough came with St. Elmo's Fire, playing Tools, a party girl with a cocaine habit, art imitating life. When Joel Schumacher threatened to fire her for partying, Columbia executive Craig Baumgarten arranged rehab. She initially balked. Filming started in 16 days. The program required 30. But that ultimatum saved her life. She could always rise to meet external expectations, but meeting her own needs? That was infinitely harder. The iconic ghost pottery scene forced Moore to confront her emotional barriers. Working with acting coach Harold Guskin, she discovered she used breath to suppress feelings, taking quick breaths and holding them whenever fear, sorrow, or rage emerged. This awareness unlocked years of suppressed emotions. The film grossed over $200 million, but she stopped reading reviews entirely. Then came the Vanity Fair cover. Annie Leibovitz photographed her pregnant with Scout in August 1991, sparking nationwide controversy. The American Society of Magazine Editors later voted it the second best magazine cover in half a century. Yet the article portrayed her as selfish and pampered, a distorted image that haunted her for years. Days after Scout's birth, Moore was already exercising obsessively. At 5 weeks, doctors revealed her excessive workouts created too much lipase in her breast milk, breaking down the fat Scout needed. She couldn't stop. She had to fit into a military uniform for a few good men in 2 months. For striptease, she earned over $12 million, becoming Hollywood's highest-paid actress. The media dubbed her Give Me More, though Bruce Willis had earned nearly double for Die Hard 3 without criticism. She restricted herself to half a cup of oatmeal daily, working out 6 days weekly. Her body obsession was an eating disorder she couldn't simply decide not to have. When Moore learned her estranged mother was gravely ill with cancer, she initially suspected a scam. They hadn't spoken in 8 years. But arriving in Farmington, New Mexico, she found Ginny truly dying, nearly bald from chemotherapy except for one stubborn red tuft. During their estrangement, Ginny had married 3 more times, increasingly controlled by addiction and her finally diagnosed bipolar disorder. Caring for her mother began Moore's own healing. She stayed throughout, lifting Ginny for baths with her G.I. Jane strength, even lighting cigarettes and holding them to her lips. There was no reason to deny this pleasure now. What had always frustrated Moore was her mother's insistence on victimhood. Now, finally, she truly was a victim, making compassion easier. Near the end, Ginny sometimes regressed to childhood, asking for a bicycle or speaking of her long-dead father. When Moore sought closure, Ginny could only say, "I wish it could have been different." Ginny died July 2, 1998. At her bedside, Moore had a moment of clarity. All her anger and pain toward her mother were hers alone now. The vessel for them was gone. This freed her to forgive herself and stop fearing she'd become her mother, a fear that had haunted her entire life. In 2003, Moore met Ashton Kutcher, 15 years her junior. When he called goodnight to her daughters with genuine warmth, he shifted from cute player to deeply compelling. Despite media fixation on their age gap, they felt completely in sync. She experienced the youthful freedom she'd missed, while he embraced fatherhood with her 3 girls. Within a year, they froze embryos. During a Mexico trip, Ashton questioned whether alcoholism was a real thing. Wanting to be that fun, normal girl, Moore broke 20 years of sobriety with a beer. At 6 months pregnant with their daughter Chaplin Ray, there was no heartbeat. Moore blamed herself for drinking and initially smoking. They married in 2005 and pursued grueling IVF rounds, daily injections, constant appointments, crushing disappointments. Moore's substance abuse spiraled. After dental surgery, she consumed 12 Vicodin pills daily. Ashton grew distant. Then news broke. He'd cheated with a 21-year-old in their home. Confronted, he deflected blame. Their previous threesomes had blurred the lines, making his betrayal somehow her fault. The January 2012 seizure severed Moore's relationship with all 3 daughters. While her family demanded rehab, she recognized substance abuse masked deeper wounds. Stripped of her role as the family's nurturing center, she confronted generations of dysfunction. Her conception as a complication from her mother's manipulative pregnancy, parents unable to protect her, and her pattern of choosing men who mirrored her father. Isolation became her catalyst. Moore addressed physical ailments, including undiagnosed autoimmune conditions and decades of buried trauma. She reframed her narrative. What if everything happened for her, not to her? This shift revealed how her resilience, while ensuring survival, had blocked true healing. Estrangement gifted her unexpected empathy for her own mother. Moore finally understood the pain she'd inflicted years before by cutting contact, bridging both relationships, first with her mother's memory, then gradually with her daughter's. In her Haley, Idaho sanctuary, Moore found peace. One New Year's Eve, alone under a full moon, she experienced complete contentment without parties or partners. Now in her mid-50s, having outlived both parents, she embraces this truth. Genuine healing requires going inward with complete honesty. Your worth isn't determined by who loves you or what you achieve. It's inherent and unchangeable.